The following Dharma discourse was given by Jeffrey Shugen Arnold. Shugen Roshi is the abbot of both the monastery and the Zen Center of New York City. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you would like to make a donation or to find out more about our various programs, please visit us online at zmm.org. Thanks for listening.
This is from the 37 verses on the practices of a bodhisattva, verse 6, relying on a spiritual friend. When in reliance on someone, your defects wane, and your positive qualities grow like the waxing moon. To cherish such a spiritual friend even more than your own body is the practice of a bodhisattva. So in a sense, this verse is continuing from the previous one about good acquaintances. And here it's talking about the role of the teacher in Buddhist practice. And the question often comes up in those new to the Dharma, new to practice, is a teacher necessary? And that's just a good question to ask. The questioner, is a teacher necessary? In a sense, it comes down to what are you seeking? What is the student seeking? This virtuous friend, it's not a friend of the usual kind. Ordinary friendships meet in shared affinities, views, interests, activities, histories. We might think of the student-teacher as meeting where samsara and enlightenment converge. When I began sitting, I was on my own and really completely on my own. I didn't, know of anybody else who was interested in Buddhism or was meditating. It was a different landscape than today. Buddhism was not popular as it is now, whatever that means. Of course, there was no internet, so there was very little. It's hard to get information. You know, you go to the encyclopedia. There are a few books, not much. But the practice of meditation made sense to me on some level. You know, I'd been studying music since I was a kid, and so I was accustomed to going into a room, closing the door, and practicing. And so when I encountered meditation, I thought, oh, that's familiar. And so I began sitting, but it was very isolated. It was very, I knew Buddhism existed. I knew that it was a major world religion, which I wasn't particularly interested in, really. It was very personal, very private, very individual, very small in a certain way. And but fortunately, perhaps because I developed that discipline, I kept practicing. And I can think about where I was. I can remember my practice, not so much in terms of what was going on in my meditation, things like that, but more like where I was at different points over those years and where I was meditating, like in my college dorm room or in my apartment when I was no longer living in a dorm or apartments in New York City and so on. Until I moved up here to the Hudson Valley and was finishing school and was still meditating, but had some sense, this dawning sort of persistent sense that I'd kind of come to the end of my rope of self-guidance, which I didn't really know what that meant because I didn't really know where this was supposed to go. But I just felt that I was kind of stuck, spinning. That I was meditating and doing the best I could, but that it was sort of gone as far as I could go. And I didn't really know what that meant either. But fortunately, a friend at the time who we were meditating together mentioned that there was a monastery about an hour away. And so we came and started coming. And I remember in terms of meeting Dada Roshi for the first time in this hall, listening to him, watching him officiate, listening to him give a talk, and realizing I mean, I don't know what I was thinking actually at that point. I just knew that what practice was up to that moment suddenly had gotten bigger. I realized somehow it was much bigger than I had known. And so it's a way of saying that my view up to that point was small, but what else could it have been? And it was very small. It was very kind of myopic. And it was very self-generated. I mean, I don't even remember, you know, knowing anything really about Buddhism. And so I didn't have much to go on in terms of my imagination. So it was small. And I, listening here to my teacher, Dada Roshi, give a talk, I realized, I felt like I was meeting a view, a mind that was quite a bit larger. I heard him say things that I did not understand, but I wanted to. He felt like he was speaking a language that was new and familiar at the same time. That he was speaking to me, but I knew in a way he wasn't. We hadn't met yet, but he was. The student, in the beginning, the student's self is very clearly existing. Their world is existing. It impinges upon them. That was certainly my experience. My world was pressing in. There were lots of struggles. And many of them I saw as outside. Some of them I saw as inside. And I had, you know, I was still young. I was in my 20s, but I'd lived long enough to have tried to wrestle myself free of some of those patterns and had been brilliantly unsuccessful at breaking those cycles. Despite my great determination, my commitment, there they went again. There I went again. And so I began studying with my teacher. And when we study, begin studying, you know, we're the same old person, of course, doing the same old stuff. And so I wanted something from my teacher. I wanted to be close. I wanted to be seen. I wanted to be valued. I wanted him to think that I was somehow had potential, maybe even special. I was hungry for praise. I wanted to have a sense of how I figured into his life. I wanted to somehow make sure that I was figuring into his life. I wouldn't have said that at the time. I certainly probably wouldn't have even thought of it that way. I was very aware of how I thought he was seeing me, which at that time I was sort of ignoring, denying, you know, distracting myself from. And with all of that, and very often the student wants to make it a personal, a thing about the personal self. I remember many, many years ago, somebody came into training, became my student, Ditto Gario. We had our first Doksan. He requested the teachings. And I think we had one Doksan after that, which was just a normal Doksan, just getting started. And he wrote me a letter afterwards withdrawing from training because how could I possibly teach him with just a few minutes of Doksan? How could I possibly know all that there was to know about his life, his interests, his experiences, his background, his family? And so I wrote back, I thought, what was a polite letter. suggesting that maybe there was something else going on, to no avail. You know, Dada Roshi rarely asked me about my personal life, though I shared, you know, things about my life and myself as time went on. And there was a part of me that, of course, wanted him to do that because I wanted that sort of sense of, isn't this a personal relationship? And of course it was, and it was different. It was clear that his interest in was different, and I knew that intellectually. And at the same time that I wanted it, there was a way in which I appreciated what was happening. That it was clear to me that what this was clear to him, even though it was not yet clear to me. And the fact that it was clear to him was immensely helpful. He never said, this is what it's about, this is the way we're going to relate to each other, this is what's going to happen. Never. And although, you know, people are different, teachers are different, there are different teaching styles, to think of it that way, there were ways in which that was very helpful. That really worked in many ways. It was very clear all the time what we were about. It was very clear what he, what my relationship with him was. And as I continued on in training, I could take more and more responsibility for that, which was important. Khyentse Rinpoche talks about someone who once asked the old Indian master, Atisha, for the teachings. Somebody approached him and said, give me your teachings. And Atisha said, ha, that sounds so nice. But to give you your instructions, I need one thing from you, faith, faith. And there can be that kind of transactional approach. Give me what you got. And when I've got it, I'll continue on my way. The teacher really wants nothing from the student. That's what's so unusual. Not ultimately. Other than their liberation, that's all. Just that. And looks for, recognizes, and tries to draw out those qualities that are going to be really important for the student. Looks for the signs and the seeds, knows that they're there. All those things that are necessary to walk the path. Faith and honesty and sincerity, patience, courage, the ability to endure difficulty and to persevere within that difficulty. When that difficulty is very strong and vigorous, and when that difficulty is very austere. In other words, when the difficulty is that there's no difficulty at all. It's not high, it's not low. That the student is able to withhold and hold their pain and their discomfort. That they're able to work on their own. And that they can be vulnerable. And most of all, most importantly, that they can be themselves. Which just might be the hardest thing of all. To study the way is to study the self. That means the whole thing. Soup to nuts. Introduction to epilogue. And along the way, there's so many things that are happening. A few of them are within our view. So many of them not. although that changes over time. And that's probably just as well. There's so much in our field anyway in the beginning, taking up space, cluttering our view, absorbing our attention. But that along the way, the student is learning, needs to learn some really basic qualities, things I never thought about, right? Not because they weren't necessarily important, but they weren't things I really thought about. They were sort of in my catalog of things I thought about, like respect. Not that I felt like I was disrespectful, but it wasn't like something I really contemplated. Reverence, that definitely was not in my table of contents. Not because, again, I felt like I was unreverential, but I just had no relationship. Well, what does that mean? Gratitude, something so simple, and yet not so easy always. And these things are to be cultivated, and the teacher needs to help the student cultivate them, not for the teacher's benefit, but for the student's. Again, the teacher doesn't really need so much. And the teacher needs to see the student, right? In a sense, the teacher's view needs to always be larger until the student and teacher merge, meet in mind. And so the teacher sees the student's self arising. They see the student's struggle, their world, but they also see those things as empty, as unhindered. They see the student as having great capacity, even when they don't see that themselves. They see the student as being sufficient, lacking nothing. You know, I think of all the times where I sat in front of my teacher and thinking, God, he probably thinks I'm the biggest idiot in the world. And being convinced that I knew what he was thinking. How could he not think that? I think it. How could he not also know? And how many times I went into him to, in a sense, almost convince him of that. Get him on my side, right? Convince him of my view. You know, bringing in my stuckness, my insecurities, my doubt. And, you know, he never supported me in those. Mm-mm. He also didn't try and take them away. He just let me have them. And his sort of open-eyed disinterest was most interesting to me. Like, okay, this is not the usual response. You're not trying to make me feel better. You're not trying to take this away. I remember one day I went in and said, with great confidence, that I just felt like nothing was really happening, nothing was really changing over these years. And he looked at me and said, yeah, well. And that was all he had to say. And I immediately started arguing with him. Need to learn about service, about how to serve. You know, that's something, you know, I have regrets. Regrets in the sense of, you know, like we all think, if I could go back, you know, if you could go back to high school and be more grown up, but be starting out, wouldn't that be great? Like you just move so smoothly through all that, those landmines, right? And so I think of that, you know, I wish I had been, there are ways in which I know I could have been a better student, you know. I could have served him better. I mean, I don't fret about that too much because I know he's okay. To cherish such a spiritual friend, even more than your own body, is the practice of a bodhisattva. What does that mean? Thubten Chodron, in her commentary, said, this has great meaning. It should make us think, how much do I actually cherish the Dharma? And this is very important. It's like, wait a minute, I thought we were talking about the teacher. Exactly. She understands. How much do I actually cherish the Dharma? For instance, she says, when someone chooses not to go to a Dharma talk because sitting till the end of the talk is too uncomfortable, the physical comfort of our body becomes more important than going for Dharma teachings and cultivating a relationship with our spiritual mentors. This happens because we're so attached to the comfort of our body. I remember a student years ago who was, you know, in his middle years, had been a student for quite a long time, very sincere, came a lot, became a senior student. And as he moved into retirement, his life situation was so good. It was so sweet that every time he came, it was harder and harder to be here. Because he just kept thinking, why am I like standing in line for the bathroom? Why am I getting up early? Right? I could be living in paradise. And so eventually he did. Go live in paradise. It's like we can convince ourselves that samsara isn't that bad. You know, we've sort of eked out a nice little patch of it, have learned how to buffer ourselves, navigate well enough, or numb ourselves against true reality. Or we think we'll live forever, or that there's time, or you fill in the rest. Those fleeting moments, pleasure, happiness, contentment, we try to make those enough. It's a seduction of a good life. And it's good to have a good life, truly, but it's also important to see how that can be seductive. That same friend who introduced me to the monastery, I was talking to her at one point about something, about myself or something, and I was basically saying in one way or another, it's good enough. And she looked at me and she said, rat's stew. I said, what? She said, rat's stew. I said, what are you talking about? And she said, it's like you're lost in the woods and you're starving to death, and suddenly you stumble upon a little community and they invite you over to have some food, and you're so ravenous, and you sit down, and it's the best food you've ever had. And you say, what is it? And they said, it's rat stew. And you think, oh my God, this is amazing. And she said, but don't know that just a mile further upstream, they're having a full banquet. Being too easily satisfied, or not hungry enough. Not hungry enough, in a sense, to sustain a long fast. Because the thing is, with practice, life improves, right? That's what should be happening. Those things, those constraints, those struggles, those worries, those states of being, they shift, they transform. And is that enough? Is that what we were looking for? Are we just looking to soften the blows, sort of put a shine on the dull sides? Or is there more? I was thinking about the passing of Ruth Bader Ginsburg, this extraordinary person. And I was watching a documentary about her, and she was talking about how how much she loved the law and cherished justice. And she thought devoting herself to the law would be the best way that she could help to bring justice, more justice into the world, particularly in relationship to women's rights. And so it was so clear that it was not for herself, just for herself from the very beginning. And her description of what she had to do to go to law school, to become a lawyer, to be a judge, all of those things at that time all those obstacles, but just her own life conditions. When she was wanting to go to law school, her husband was already in law school and she was pregnant, or no, she already had a child. And her father said to her, said, look, you know, it's perfectly reasonable for you not to go to law school. Like, that would make sense to anybody. You're married, you have a kid. He said, but if you want to go, you'll figure it out. You'll find a way. And she did. And what she had to do, at one point, she's got children, her husband has cancer, is homebound, getting radiation. She arranges for some of his classmates to take notes, which they give to her. She types them up so he can keep studying from her bed while she's got all of her own classes to study for and take care of the family. And her children said that, you know, she would frequently get maybe a couple hours of sleep a night. You can't do that just on sheer will. She had bodhicitta for the law, right? And not just for the law, but for what she wanted to do, what she wanted to bring. And of course, there were sacrifices. You know, as I'm listening to her children talk, I'm thinking, wow, how is that for the family? Kind of like the Buddha leaving home. And it's just like that. There are sacrifices we make, right? Monastics leave their home. We don't go home for every family event. There are things we give up. There are things you give up. If you're a parent, there are things you're going to give up, sacrifices you're going to make, you're making to raise that child well, to be really committed to some work or some effort, some endeavor that is important to you, is essential to you, means other things are not going to happen or they're going to happen differently. That's what we do. And sometimes there's fallout. So it's not a perfect life. Every relationship is not perfect. And we can do the best we can within that, to take care of them and recognize we are making choices and they are impacting others and there can be enormous benefit that in many ways doesn't come any other way, doesn't come into the world any other way. Children said, the role spiritual mentors play in our life is extremely important. She said, think about it. Our parents love us tremendously, but can they teach us the path to enlightenment? Don't even try. Not a good idea. Worldly friends may care for us a lot, but can they teach us Dharma methods to counteract anger and clinging? The people who are able to teach us how to free our mind and escape from the prison of cyclic existence are rare and very, very precious. And what's so important, and that's why I so appreciated about my relationship with Adaroshi, is because it was clear that that was his purpose. Was to help me be free. And there are many times where that in the teacher is going to be even stronger than it is in the student. That's almost a given. And that needs to shift. And so in that way, personalities, views, interests, politics, habits, behaviors are really important insofar as they can be useful. As they can be useful in our training as a student or in the teacher's teaching the Dharma. Dogen said, to understand the Dharma and attain the way can only be the result of studying with a teacher. However, when practicing and inquiring of a teacher, listen to their words without matching them with your own personal views. So think of how we give instruction listening to a teisho, to listen to those given to you and to just take it in, to hear as a meditation, to not respond, to not be speaking back, to not be arguing, to not be correcting just here. Take it in without matching them with our own previous views. He said, if you understand their words in terms of your own views, you'll not be able to grasp their meaning. And that's how we can kind of try and appropriate the Dharma. It's like, take it and sort of try and fit it into the holes in the square and the round holes that we already have. And sort of get it to line up with where we're already at. What's the point of that? There's a wonderful story about Milarepa, the great singing yogi, and one of his principal students, Rachungpa, who was clearly a very, you know, gifted student and was already very close to Milarepa and was already quite accomplished. And Milarepa at one point sent him to India. Yeah, they were in Tibet. So he sent him to India to study with certain very important teachers and to get very important texts, teachings, and bring them back. Texts that didn't exist yet in Tibet. And so he went and he spent some considerable amount of time and a huge amount of energy and risk and so on to do all of this. And so he comes back and he's very, very proud of what he's done, of his accomplishment, that he studied with these great masters. His teacher didn't study with those masters. He has these teachings that his teacher hasn't even seen. And he can't wait to get into them and to show what he knows and to share what he's learned. He's had such this amazing experience. And Milarepa says, I want to go to this place, to this village, and see the people there. And that really pisses Rachungpa off because he's like, what? I just came back and I've got these books. And they're like, what are you talking about? And so he goes. He's not happy about it, but he goes because it's his teacher. And so they camp for the night because they're still en route. And Milarepa sends him to go get some water. He says, I'm going to build a fire. You go get some water. So Milarepa builds a fire, and Rachungpa is going to get water, and on his way, he finds a little valley with a bunch of goats, and they're playing. There's some young goats, one just born, and he's enthralled with these goats. They're so beautiful, they're frolicking, and he just gets lost in it, right? And after a while, he goes, oh, wait a minute, I my teacher's waiting for me, and so he gets the water and comes back. Meanwhile, Milarepa has built a fire and has gone through the books one by one, looking at them, making an offering, and then burns them. All but a couple. So when Rachungpa is coming back, he's getting close and he sees the fire. He's, that smells like paper burning. And so he runs over and says, what happened? And he said, oh, I burned all your books, except the good ones. He said, the ones I burned weren't important. They were useless. And Rachungpa goes into a rage. He is not happy about this. He says, are my books burned? When he entered the cave, he saw there was almost nothing left. He felt as if his heart had been torn asunder. Where are my books? He cries out in resentment. And Milarepa says, you were gone for so long, I thought you were dead. So I burned them all. He says, but as far as I'm concerned, most of them were useless. They're just temptations to distract your mind and hinder your devotion. By the way, why were you gone so long? In his pride, Rachungpa thought, my guru has become completely bitter and egoistic. He's completely self-centered. Like, he's out of his mind. He's affronted me. He's hurt my feelings. He said, I think I should leave. I shouldn't study with this person anymore. And so thinking that he had lost all of his face, he's sitting there in a dead quiet. And then finally he says, I was watching some goats play. He says, that's why I was late. He says, but all the gold that I've received and the hardship that I went through in India has all become meaningless, wasted. I'm leaving now for another country. And so saying this, Rachungpa became hostile and disdainful to his teacher, had bad faith towards him. And Milarepa says, my son, he says, you don't have to lose all your faith in me. He says, all this should be blamed on your dalliance. If you want to be amused, I'll amuse you. And he started this amazing display of miracles. So first he manifests all of these different Buddhas, one on the right side, one on the left side, one on top of his head, full living Buddhas. And Rachungpa's pays no attention, not interested, but just sits there silently in deep resentment. He kind of looks over at the miracles happening over here, but doesn't show the slightest sign. And then he says, you know, there's nothing surprising in all this. It's more amusing to watch the goats. And so then he shows neither interest nor admiration, keeps asking him, give me back my books. Why don't you give me my books? If you want to do a miracle, give me my books. He sits there in persistent indignation and silence. Then he gets up, stamps heavily around, sits down again, puts his elbows on his knees, rests his chin in his hands, and begins to hum meaninglessly. Can't you just see it? Meanwhile, Milarepa is still displaying just an endless array of miracles. He passes through rocks. He flies by sitting on a rock. And Richimpa says, your miracles are wonderful, but I will not be at ease if I can't have my books back. And Milarepa says, don't lose your faith in me. So the Milarepa walks by on water. And then he sits down on water. And Richimpa says, your miracles are like child's plays. You've shown them already. They're getting dull and boring. He says, if you really want to be compassionate, give me back my books. Milarepa says, don't lose faith. He says, if you practice sincerely, you'll see that every manifestation is a holy book. So then Milarepa pours fire and water out of his body. And then he takes this huge boulder and just cuts it like it's soft earth with his hand. And Richimpa says, you know, if you can perform the miracles of returning my books, then I'll have faith. Otherwise, I can't be happy. And Milarepa says, look, try to straighten out your mind. When I see someone like you, a student who's lost all faith, at this time of defilement, I feel sad and sick at heart. He says, listen, an ivory horn or a solid piece of wood, you can bend it if you try, but a harsh mind is very hard to bend. Try to subdue your mind. Your mind is lost. Try to catch it. Try to see your own faults. Try to meditate on your unborn mind. Try to change your temper and your vanity. Give up all your desires for pleasure. See that the self-face of your mind is hard. Make use of impermanence and your imminent death. Avoid the demon of egoism that has you. When I come to die, this is what I will wish for you. And as he's saying all this, he's singing, because that's how he taught. He's singing. And as he's singing, he floats up into the air and just disappears. It's gone. And at that moment, Ruchungpa is suddenly filled with this remorse. And it says, has an unusual faith born in him. And he realizes what he's done. And he completely breaks down and says, I paid too great a price for those worthless books. What is the use of them without my teacher? He finds him. He actually finds him and he hugs him so hard that he faints. So, of course, this is a very large story, right? Very large. But what is it telling us? And remember, Thubten Chodron says, in terms of cherishing the teacher, is how much do I cherish the Dharma? Dogen says, when you practice with a teacher and inquire about the Dharma, clear out your body and mind. Quiet your eyes and your ears and listen. Listen and receive the teaching without mixing in your own thoughts. Your body and mind will be one, which is a receptive receptacle to be filled with water. And so, of course, faith is important. It sort of equals our ability to listen, to engage, to trust, to let go. It does not mean to abdicate personal responsibility or common sense, the student also has many responsibilities. It's not always clear as we're studying, as we're learning, whether a certain teaching or request by the teacher is for our benefit. Is the teacher just being egoistic? Are they just being self-serving? And so part of this is understanding our own level of trust or difficulty with trust, our own doubt, our wariness, which is going to have a lot to do with what we've experienced, perhaps both in Dharma practice previously, but also in our lives. And so that faith that is so important, all of these qualities that are so important, are in a constant state, potentially, of developing and developing and developing. And that story with Rechungpa is such a wonderful example of that, of these of moments where there is a kind of crisis of faith, a loss of faith in the teacher. In the what? In the Dharma. But to not abdicate one's own power. You know, I thought often of the movie Million Dollar Baby, where the boxing trainer, Clint Eastwood, is talking about training a boxer. You know, and he's an old gruff, rough around the edges guy. And he's saying the boxers always have these huge egos, right? They have these huge egos. They're incredibly arrogant. So you have to sort of pound that out of them, grind that out of them to make them malleable so you can actually train them, he says. He says, but if you take it all gone, they're useless. He says, you have to leave some fight in them. The Dalai Lama said, it's very important for a student to examine the behavior of a spiritual guide. For the time being, act like a spy. Otherwise, if you have some sense of faith and immediately take on the teacher, the person as a teacher, then in time your mind might change and you'll become disillusioned. There's no hurry other than death. You should take your time. It's very important to not be mistaken. And I remember, I mean, I never thought of myself as being a spy, but when I came here in the early years, I mean, for years, I would watch him. I would watch my teacher to learn, I mean, and to gain trust and to learn, to see all the different situations. And as time went on, in the beginning, I tended to take all of them as perfect, all of them as an enlightened behavior. And as I went on, I saw, okay, there are other things going on here, too. And I realized, I came here to enlighten my mind, to study the Dharma. Can I use that too? And in that way, in encountering my teacher's humanity, my teacher's human qualities, his strengths and foibles, could I use that too? He couldn't prevent me. Dogen says something interesting in the same fascicle. This is guidelines for studying the way. He says, when you first enter the gate to study the Buddha way, listen to the teacher's instruction and practice as instructed. When you do that, there's something you should know. Dharma turns you, and you turn Dharma. When you turn Dharma, you are leading, and the Dharma is following. On the other hand, when Dharma turns you, Dharma is leading, and you are following. Buddha Dharma originally has these two modes. Those who are not true heirs or are not yet clear do not understand this. What does that mean? When the Dharma turns you, the Dharma is leading and you are following. So one way we might look at that is that when we come in, we have to follow the Dharma, right? Because we haven't encountered it yet. The Dharma has to lead. In the same way that sometimes when you don't have faith or you're feeling listless and you don't really want to sit, You let your body lead you. Let your body lead. Your mind will follow. That's good enough. Let the Dharma guide you. Let go into it. Let it fill your body and mind. Follow it deeply. Study it. And know, and then when the Dharma, when you turn the Dharma, you are leading. And the Dharma is following. So over time, more and more as you chant the sutra, you realize this is your, these are your words. This is your experience. When you hear the teachings, they begin to be things you now know. In the end, how is all of this? Master Wang Po said, in all of China, there are no teachers of Zen. There's plenty of Zen, there's just no teachers. He was a Zen master speaking to his ordained community who had given their lives to the Dharma, living in a monastery, studying with him. In all of China, there are no teachers. What does he mean? I said the other day, if we get a very quick and easy, oh, I get it, stop right there. Consider more deeply. Zen has always been here. Bodhidharma did not bring it from India. Dada Roshi used to say this quite often. Mazumi Roshi did not bring it from Japan, within monasteries, training halls. There is Zen sufficient for a lifetime. Where are the teachers? What is the teacher that you should cherish more than your body? In one of Master Sheng Yan's books, he talks about leaving his teacher to having finished training and continuing on. And as he's leaving, he's expressing his gratitude, he's making bows, and he's assuring him that as he leaves, he says, I will not disappoint you. And his teacher says, don't worry about disappointing me. He said, don't disappoint yourself. How much do we cherish this Dharma? What does that mean? I wanted to... Tomorrow, we're going to do a mando to end the session. And I want to talk about the fearlessnesses of the Bodhisattva. We've been studying these verses. We're still just at the beginning. But we're in the midst of such abundance of samsara. That we're all aware of in different degrees and all holding within ourselves in different ways. And some are right in the thick of it. And so I wanted to look at these fearlessnesses, which are not directly spoken of in these verses, but are present within and throughout them. And to really look at them from in relationship to the Bodhisattva vow. What is it that stops us? This great vow, right? It is a great vow. Like, nobody hid that from you, right? That was put out front, right in the beginning. This is a great vow. It just turns out to be much greater than we thought, than we imagined. And so, I wanted to say that just to let you think about that a little bit in terms of what are those things within these teachings, within this Anga of Bodhisattva attention, and in our world, with all that's going on and all of the ways in which that sits in us, and what we might feel we are called to do, what we might think we are being expected to do. What does it mean to save all sentient beings? What does that mean? And what can we as an individual, as just a person, and as a community do? So we'll look at that. So, don't worry about disappointing anybody else. Just don't disappoint yourself. What would that be? Milarepa said, I think it was Milarepa who said, the reward is to die without regret.
Thanks for listening. Did you know that Zen Mountain Monastery is live streaming all Dharma talks and daily Zazen during the coronavirus quarantine? Visit our website to learn about all the online programs being offered at this time. Just go to zmm.org and click on the link at the very top of the page, or scroll down and click on Retreats.